What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
Thanks to your botched Berlin job, you all made Interpol's top 10 most wanted list.
Top 10?
Mm-hmm.
That's all right.
Well, not you, Roman.
What do you mean?
You just missed the cut. You're number 11. So.
The one and only Kurt Russell with Tyrese Gibson in The Fate of the Furious. That's Fast and Furious 8 for the uninitiated. Gibson's Roman on the outside looking in of that top 10 Interpol most wanted list. He'd no doubt be even more disappointed to learn that he failed to make Film Spotting's also very official top 5 Fast and Furious moments. This week on the show, we'll revisit that 2015 list along with a review of the 8th installment of the Furious series. The next picture shows Tasha Robinson and Genevieve Kosky riding shotgun with me for that review. It's all ahead on Film Spotting. Our little gift to you for subscribing to the Film Spotting podcast, an all fast, all furious episode of the show every other April, it seems. This offer also available to anyone currently listening to the show. Back in April 2015, because we take our jobs very seriously, Josh and I got current with the Furious franchise in anticipation of Furious 7. The series made its debut back in 2001. The culmination of that dubious effort was our top 5 Fast and Furious moments, a list we will revisit later in the show. And for those of you still unfamiliar with or completely uninterested in the franchise, this top 5 will serve as an excellent primer. Listen to the whole thing, and it'll feel like you've watched all 7 movies right along with us. Very sadly, Josh was not able to join me for a review of the latest installment, but in keeping with the Fast and Furious crew's emphasis on family, I kept things in the Film Spotting family by inviting the next picture show's Tasha Robinson and Genevieve Kosky to join me. Here's our review.
Dominic Toretto just went rogue.
You gonna turn your back on family?
I know it looks bad. Don't give up on him so easy.
We've only got one chance to make this family whole again.
Don't do this, Dom.
You ready?
One thing I can guarantee, no one's ready for this.
Will you go to a screening of The Fate of the Furious, looking for a critic to sit shotgun in Josh's absence? Somehow I end up with two cool writers here in the studio, formerly of The Dissolve, now of other outlets, including the Next Picture Show podcast. I have Tasha Robinson and Genevieve Kosky back on Film Spotting. Thank you for doing this, guys.
Well, I mean, we kind of had to do this. We're part of the Film Spotting family. And let me emphasize the word family, because Fate of the Furious, family, 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 family.
You pronounce it wrong. It's family.
Well, I pronounce everything wrong by that standard. Yeah. And I need to
start pronouncing things better.
You don't speak diesel, but we're going to give it our best shot here. And you're right. Family, so important. I knew I could count on you. By the time people hear this, this movie will have been out for a week and likely made a ton of money. As we sit here right now, we just walked out of an early screening, so this is a still processing review of The Fate of the Furious, and oh, there's so much to process. Why has Vin Diesel's Dominic Toretto gone rogue and betrayed that family, Tasha? And how will his crew stop him and baddie Charlize Theron from doing whatever bad things they're trying to do? In 2015, Josh and I filled in our Fast and the Furious blind spots. We watched the whole series and shared our top 5 Fast and Furious moments. So you could say we're experts, and overall, we're fans, if not fans of every single film in the series, or saga, as Vin Diesel calls it. But where do you guys fall? That's first. And then second, tell me why I need to rethink the fact that I just had 2 hours and 16 minutes of pure fun. Tasha, we'll start with you.
Well, I'm certainly not going to say that you need to rethink that. I'm a fan of the series. I mean, in the same sort of way that I'm a fan of candy. I feel like...
I'm a big fan of candy. Maybe that explains a lot.
I feel like this entire series, like, I've seen them all. I've never done the sit down and do them as a marathon thing. I'm given to understand that if you do sit down and watch them in marathon form, the timeline makes a lot more sense. And
True.
The through lines of the series make a lot more sense. And I would imagine that this film in particular would make a lot more sense because it's comprised, I want to say, approximately 60% of confectioner's sugar, 20% explosions, and 20% fan service.
Hmm.
And it's
we could
full.
Check your math, but it's close. It's close.
Why would you want to check my math when you could just hit the NOS and go to 250 miles an hour?
Good point.
These are fun movies, but at this point, they're fun movies that are made entirely with one eye closed in a constant wink at the audience. There are so many things that happen that are just there to be callbacks and references and acknowledgments and an elbow in the ribs mm-hmm. saying, hey, we all remember the last time this happened. Here it's happening again.
Yeah.
But this one plays with the formula a little by having Dominic Toretto go rogue.
Right.
As one of the characters says, your team is about to go up against the only thing they can't handle, you. So, I mean, as far as script flipping goes, this has an idea to it, a fundamental idea that I think is fun. And I certainly had fun with it. I'm not going to try to tell you didn't have fun with it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're allowed to have fun.
Did you have fun?
I did have fun. I always have fun with these movies the first time I see them. They are not movies that I ever feel a compulsion to go back and revisit. Mm-hmm. In the few times I have, I've found a lot less enjoyable experience, both watching at home as opposed to on the big screen, and just like I said, watching it a second time. Mm-hmm. It's the appeal of this series is kind of what Tasha was alluding to, just like the winking and the seeing how it's going to top itself and the element of surprise in that respect. And once you have that, you can't get it again on a second watch, you know, and you're kind of left with this increasingly unwieldy lore, Fast and the Furious lore, that honestly I don't care that much about. Mm-hmm. You know, I came here to see stuff get blown up real good. And once I seen it get blown up real good, I don't really need to see it again.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's fair. And yet I had enough fun with this movie. And maybe it was seeing it on the big screen, which I don't think I saw any of the other films on the big screen. Actually, I watched them all at home on DVD, except Furious 7, which we reviewed in 2015. So that's the one I saw, and I really enjoyed it. But I actually was, during the film this time, thinking to myself, I'd go to this again. I enjoyed all of the action scenes enough, all of the staged car scenes, as they inevitably, of course, involve lots and lots of cars. I enjoyed them all enough that I actually could see myself watching this movie again. And you're right, Tasha, that the movie certainly does have its share of winking. There was only one time, and I take terrible notes, so I can't remember the time. There was one instance where I felt like, okay, that was really shoehorned in. I did not need that. But otherwise, I thought it was clever enough, and it's always adding something new. So we get an element in this film like Helen Mirren showing up with this wonderful, sleazy sort of Cockney accent. And it's fun. Again, I'm going to go back to that word because I don't know what else to use, but she's really enjoyable in this movie, as is Jason Statham, who I never really got into any of those transporter movies. I didn't watch them. I now think after seeing the last two Fast and the Furious films, I need to go back and revisit them because maybe I'd enjoy them just because I like his presence so much. I like his camaraderie or anti-camaraderie, I guess, with The Rock. I think every time they're jawing at each other, again, is fun. I kind of wish we got to see that big showdown that they keep promising each other, as we did see at the end of Furious 7. So those elements, adding some of the new stuff, getting more Statham in this film, and the action scenes, that's enough for me. I felt like F. Gary Gray is the director. This is the first time he's directed one of these films. I really liked the clarity of the action scenes. I felt like there was a lot of clarity to the action scenes. You guys did not. I can see by your reaction.
I think we're both going to argue with you on
okay.
that one.
Let's do it.
There are some of the bigger set pieces I thought were visually clear and easy to follow and followed a logical action sequence. There's a sequence involving a bunch of car harpoons where the setup for
you
it
mean
is
carpoons.
I do mean carpoons. I did not realize until this moment that I meant carpoons, but I absolutely did mean carpoons. There's a sequence with a bunch of carpoons where the setup is very visually clear, and then what follows after that, as far as I'm concerned, is just like visual mishmash.
Hmm.
Like physics doesn't make sense, space doesn't make
it never
sense.
Never has in this series, really.
That's really true.
Dubai
but
in Furious 7, that's all I'll say.
There's a lot of stuff that happens in sort of the final big action set piece of this film that is physics nonsense, but it's visually clear physics nonsense.
Yes.
Like nuclear submarines do not behave like mechanical bulls in bars.
Right.
But when one starts to do that, you can see like where it is and what it's doing. You can visually follow what's going on. I still don't really understand how the carpoons scene got resolved. So there were a few sequences here and there like that. Genevieve, what was it for you?
Well, first of all, I'll tell you how the carpoon scene got resolved because of good old Detroit Steel American Muscle Car 5,000 horsepower.
That's it.
It was horsepower. Car physics, Tasha.
That's not car physics. That's cartoon.
Well, I thought that whole sequence, though, in New York City was inspired.
Yeah.
That was something that I never really could have imagined seeing, and I don't really want to give it away. We saw cars falling out of airplanes in Furious 7. I loved, as Josh put it, the Zen chaos of that sequence, and I think we get it even more here in the New York City sequence with, I'll say, cars not falling from planes, but just falling from everywhere.
I believe they're referred to as zombie cars.
Zombie cars.
Zombie time.
As Charlize calls them.
It's and also so, referred to as making it rain.
Making
which
it rain.
Used to mean something else.
But now it's taken on new meaning because of this film. It worked for me. And Charlize Theron, we mentioned her. She's the villain in this film. And early on, I found myself kind of enjoying her performance and seeing her relish being the bad guy, if you will. But that otherwise is, for me, the only real weakness of the film, I am sad to say. I felt like her performance became very one note as the film went on. You realize that she was going to play every scene with her eyes wide open and just talking really slowly. And that was supposed to be menacing somehow, and it wore off. She's a great actress, and I love her in a lot of roles, but not so much here. Yeah.
I gotta tell you, this whole saving the world, Robin Hood nonsense you've been doing recently, it's not you. Be who you are. Why live only a quarter mile at a time when you can live your whole life that way?
Well, there's like no real physical element to her presence or to the threat of that character. Like, she stands behind a console and yells.
Yeah.
And like,
she's a hacker.
Yeah, exactly.
And she's a hacker named Cypher. Which, when I found that out, I was like, is there a big tough guy named Bruiser and a little scientist with glasses?
Isn't
named
there a
Specs?
Cypher in the Matrix too?
Oh, yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's
and
the Joe
that
Canaliano character.
From the Matrix?
Oh, gosh. Yes.
That's true, actually.
Twitch got robbed, man.
Yeah.
But like, this is a series that places so much value on just like physical action and things ramming into each other. And her character embodies none of that. It's a very stagnant character. And I mean, like you said, I think Theron does a good job with what she's given. But what she's given is like tapping at a screen and
really
you know.
Fast and hard.
Yeah.
That's really physical. You're right.
I personally liked the physicality of that performance. I liked that performance in general because she is surrounded. I mean, one of the hallmarks of the series is gigantic dudes who are constantly throwing other gigantic dudes through plate glass. It's all about the not just the physicality, but the bulk and the power of like very, very strong men. And having this slim little woman who is comparatively still and who doesn't mug as much, who does have that the kind of frozen face and calm demeanor. I liked the contrast of that.
Yeah.
And I thought it was
And I think
effective.
I did too very early on. That's what really drew me to the performance. And I felt, I guess, that it became a little bit redundant. Maybe she didn't get enough interesting things to do or say. And I think that's a problem too. And look, anybody who talks about these films is going to say, well, what did you expect? A Paddy Chayefsky screenplay? No, it's not. But there is, in that last half hour or so, such an abundance of action and that extended sequence that we're used to getting with these films, a very big, prolonged action scene, which, again, I love for the most part, the whole ice Russian submarine thing. We see parts of it in the trailer. I think it's very good. But it is a lot of cutting to people in cars and behind consoles saying really dumb 2 to 3 word phrases that are so cliche, they really did not find an interesting way to intercut those scenes, intercut the action with some actual dialogue, with getting us back into the characters. if you will. Did you find that too?
Well, I mean, for me, there's so much incredibly over-the-top cliche dialogue in this film. And it, I mean, it opens. This film literally opens with a streetcar race, which is there to remind us that this series started out as a streetcar series.
Right.
This film is meant to be the first in a new trilogy, moving it in an international spy direction and away from
moving
the street
it.
Racing.
Yeah, I think those last three films or so were there.
We're like just pinning it down in the position it's been
perhaps
in.
Moving it further. This is just this is what one of the producers described where the series is going from here. It's meant to be a little bit of a break, but of course we have to start off with a street race. And it's a street race in Havana where we are informed that the fastest car on the island is about to race the slowest car on the island. And we get both of those pieces of information delivered at a shout. You know, no, you can't race with my car. My car is the slowest car on the island. I kept hearing Speedy Gonzales cartoons and, you know, somebody saying, oh, he's the fastest mouse in all Mexico. It just the contrast cannot be this car is faster than that car. This is the fastest car on the entire island versus the slowest car on the entire island. The entire movie operates with that kind of logistics.
Yes.
This is the biggest and the baddest and the best at all times. So there's so much
and it's
dialogue.
Still thrilling to watch.
It's still thrilling to watch, but it's thrilling to watch because of the physicality of the action and because the performances are very conscious of the fact that this is all not to be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I don't think that the dialogue went in a cliche direction. I think it was there from the start. Everybody's just cramming scenery into their mouths by the handful. And again, I liked that Charlize Theron kind of played it a different way. I think she had to play it a different way because at this point, you can't be bigger than the biggest people that are already in the movie.
And Vin Diesel does get big in this role in ways actually that I don't think we've seen him at any other point in the series, not only emotionally, but he yells, which we don't ever really see Vin Diesel yell. He doesn't lose his cool that often. He just relies on that physical brooding presence. So I don't know. I thought that was a new wrinkle.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of fully transitioned into superhero status at with this movie. Like, I mean, it's definitely been going in that direction for a while. But like with Paul Walker no longer with the franchise, no longer with us, it's kind of had to pivot to I don't know. Like, I felt like there was some, I don't want to call them growing pains in this movie, but you could just feel like them kind of recalibrating this and how Dom is going to function in this series without the counterpoint of Brian. And I think kind of the bromance angle that they had has been grafted onto Hobbs and Shaw and their dynamic there.
Yeah, so the, like, Rock and
the Rock and Jason Statham, yeah. So Vin Diesel is kind of on his own now, and the plot of this movie also serves to separate him out from the team and kind of establishes him as a force unto himself. So
true.
Diesel has to do a lot more here. I honestly don't know if he pulls it off. I tend to find him the weakest part of these movies, and I don't think he was egregiously
even
bad here.
Even acting opposite Paul Walker, who, rest his soul, was pretty wooden as an actor.
I guess. I don't know. There's just something about Vin Diesel's characterization of Dom that does not sit right with me, but that's maybe more on me than on him. But anyway, like, there's definitely a shift in his characterization in this movie, I think, for sure.
What are you doing?
Poor man's turbo. Pull the vacuum line and hold on. Old trick the bus used to play in case of emergencies.
You know that's way too much boost for that engine.
It's gonna be fast.
It's gonna be a bomb.
Only needs to go a mile.
So as this series goes forward, we get more films in this saga. I think you make a great point, Genevieve, that by splitting him off in this film, it wouldn't surprise me if at least they were keeping their options open. I don't know how much the producers have mapped all of this out, but they give themselves the option of splintering him off a little bit, and maybe some of these other peripheral characters are going to fall by the wayside, or we're going to introduce a new glut of those characters. But that's another thing. Yeah, the next generation. And he'll be the ringleader, of course, as he is, the alpha male. But that's another thing I do respond to with this film. I enjoy all of those other characters, all the other members of the family. And I enjoy the in-jokes that have built up now over watching these films. Even Tyrese's shtick, where he's always the loudest and the most obnoxious in the room, I usually find pretty funny. And I think that you add a guy like Kurt Russell in, who, when is Kurt Russell not interesting on screen.
He's great.
He knows exactly what movie he's in, and I think is a joy every time we see him. And
he needs to tell Scott Eastwood what movie he's in.
Maybe so. And I don't even know. I don't know where to go, because it's not like I think he gives a bad performance, but he also doesn't necessarily give me hope that I can't wait to see him more in this series. I don't know how you guys felt, but those characters like Tyrese, like Ludacris, I enjoy. I enjoy their camaraderie and their give and take.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy the dynamic specifically between Tyrese Gibson and Ludacris. That back and forth competition, I think, gives the series. I mean, this is a series with a lot of humor to it, but kind of the heart of it is the fact that they are constantly competing with each other. And to some degree, we have a similar dynamic going on with Dom and Hobbs, especially in Fast Five. They seem to have sort of settled out. So now we've got Jason Statham coming in to kind of, you know, put the triangle point on that competition. But there's always so much macho push. These are very macho movies. These movies are all about people with attitude who are not necessarily all men. You know, they're all macho, but they're not necessarily all men. But it's all about dominance. It's all about them pushing and who's on top at any given moment. And I enjoy the testosterone-fueled competition that goes on, but I kind of enjoy it most when it's in that verbal state that goes back and forth between Tej and Roman, where they're constantly picking at each other. Although there's a sequence here that happens in a jail between Dwayne Johnson and Jason Statham that was one of my favorite things in the movie.
Absolutely.
I love a good jailbreak sequence.
Right.
And when we were talking about the action scenes, I almost didn't want to say this because it feels blasphemous, but I think my favorite action scenes in this movie are the ones not involving cars.
Yeah. What?
Because I loved the jailbreak sequence and I loved the climactic plane fight. Also, both Statham. Sequences, which probably says something as well.
Yeah, I want to jump back to that for a second. You were talking about maybe revisiting the Transporter movies. Have you seen many other Jason Statham films?
Well, no. Spy. I mean, this felt so much to me like it was trading on his performance in Spy.
You don't want to jump straight to Spy, though.
Yeah.
Spy is like a payoff for a career. There are a lot, I think, of better Jason Statham movies than the Transporter movies.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also one of those people who, much like Vin Diesel and much like Dwayne Johnson, has had a career that's moved from very serious, very tough action roles to wink-wink action roles, where he's still physically impressive, but he's funny as well in a very, like, dialed down serious kind of way. And I mean, he fits so perfectly, given where he's come in his career, he fits so perfectly into the kind of competition and the kind of sense of humor here. I don't necessarily see that dynamic happening in the Transporter movies. I would watch something like Crank, which is insanely over the top, but has that kind of, we know this is ridiculous and we're enjoying the ridiculousness of it.
Yeah, I've only seen bits of Crank late at night, sort of on HBO, you know, as you're flipping channels. And sometimes I do get sucked into it, but I probably saw him first, like everyone else, in his first two movies were Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch. And I don't remember how big of a role he had there. He certainly wasn't a name at the time, and he wasn't a name I would have remembered. I think the first time I was really aware of him, watching him, was The Bank Job, which is an okay film and not an overt action film, not one that certainly relies on the physicality of the Transporter movies, but those movies had made him a star by that point. So for me, even though I was not that familiar with his work, I was familiar with what he's known for and his persona, and that was enough for me to enjoy in Spy, and it was enough for me to enjoy as well in Furious 7. And here, I definitely feel like this series, if it moved forward without him playing a prominent role, I'd be pretty disappointed.
Yeah. Well, oh, me too.
Well, yeah. And I mean, this movie in particular does something really smart that actually this series has done a few times over, which is turn an antagonist into part of the team. I mean, I think Jason Statham was the bad guy. He was the one they were fighting in Furious 7. And now he's just a part of the team. And like, that's kind of the case with Hobbs too.
Yeah.
Like, he was originally battling the team, you know.
Out to get him, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So like, by switching him from an antagonist to protagonist, he can be more fun. He doesn't have to have the threat. Not saying that he was super threatening and he wasn't fun in Furious 7,
sure,
but he's allowed to lean into it even more here.
And that also gives you an excuse to keep him around forever, because an antagonist eventually has to be defeated, but yet another family member can be kept around for the next 27 movies.
Right.
There you go. On that note, Any closing thoughts? Anything you haven't been able to get off your chest about the fate of the Furious?
Well, we haven't really talked much about Letty and Michelle Rodriguez, because what struck me here is that Dom's fate kind of mirrors her in the sixth movie, Fast and Furious 6.
Yeah.
The titling on these movies, man, it's so hard. But, you know, she had amnesia and she was battling the team then. So
she went rogue.
Yeah, she went rogue.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that those two characters who are in love and in a relationship now, like, have that shared experience and perhaps explains Letty's reluctance in this film to
give up on her.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, that's something that kind of speaks to the lore or mythology that this franchise has built, that I think actually helps make these movies not quite as much of a trifle as they could be without it.
Yeah.
That said, I'm so glad that we're at least for now done with, like, Letty drama, basically.
Hopefully.
That whole thing to me was just, it was such a, like, a cheap soap opera serial kind of plot device.
And amnesia?
yes, amnesia. And
exactly.
Now we have her, right, and now she's turned rogue, but now we've got her back, but she's still got amnesia.
And all these people coming back from the dead, right?
It is a gigantic soap opera.
It is.
This one felt a lot more direct and action based to me.
Yes.
There are sort of hiccups with that. Like there are points where I would have liked to have a pause between action sequences. Mm-hmm. And the big one here is we have a sequence where they're more or less, okay, we have to do a big heist. There's a thing, it's in a place, it's gonna be incredibly hard to get to it. And then they just cut to, like, maybe 2 minutes before the aftermath of that. Like, we fast-forwarded past the heist. We fast-forwarded past the heist falling apart. We're just going to cut straight to the
Are you talking about the Berlin sequence?
Yeah. Yes.
See, actually, I loved that element.
I loved it, too.
I love that because that was such a clear nod to the fact that we know what they've done. We've seen them do it a million times. Let's just get to what's important, which is how they split off. Let's get to the aftermath. I thought that was a really creative touch.
I love a heist movie, though. I love watching heists come together. I love watching plans be built and then fall apart. And it was literally like eating the frosting and not getting the cake.
Yeah, that's what I loved about it.
Some people love it. Some people love frosting. I'd rather have the cake.
No, I'm with you that I generally love watching a plan come together. I'm like Hannibal from the A-Team that way. And I love seeing the crew and I love everything about the planning. But in this case, I felt like they knew they had bigger things to get to. And let's just get to what everyone expects.
Yeah. The audacity of it is what sold me more, you know. And I mean, if I want a heist, there's lots of heists in this franchise. Like, I'll go back and watch the vault.
I do want to know what you guys thought of a choice the movie makes. And we won't spoil it here because I won't get into the details of it. But if you've seen the trailer for the film and you've only seen that, and we've talked about, of course, the fact that the plot hinges on Dominic Toretto going rogue. Just based on the trailer, you would really think, or at least I thought, that that was probably something that was carried through to the end of the film. And we would never really learn why, or at least not fully understand why he did that until the end of the movie. So, much to my surprise, we learn earlier than halfway into the film what exactly is going on. The movie does choose to reveal what his motivations are. And I know now, considering the whole scope of the plot, why that's the case and why they felt they had to do that. But were you guys surprised by that at all? And do you think that they actually could have maybe hung on to that a little bit longer to give us a little bit more suspense about, okay, maybe he's gone rogue truly and he has these reasons, and what if he has turned on these people for all time? Or is that just so ludicrous that that you wouldn't have gone there anyway? What did you guys think?
It's so Tyrese Gibson.
Yeah.
I don't think that they could have held on to it for a variety of reasons. One of which is the reason that he goes rogue is really important to the emotional characteristics of the film.
Totally. Yep.
And to establishing one of your favorite words, the stakes.
Yeah.
The stakes are pretty high here, and it gives them an opportunity to kind of delve into that, to lean into that really hard in ways that there's no way to explain without spoiling something. But letting you know what's at stake pretty early on makes the movie hold together a lot better than I think it would be if you were just left thinking. Because I think the reaction to him doing such a face heel turn, if such a thing exists, is that's ridiculous. These movies have built up this ridiculously humongous emotional content around family, the word they repeat over and over and over.
Sometimes familia.
It's true.
Familia. If he was to just abandon that and the movie spent the whole 2-hour and 15-minute runtime letting you question why and then gave you a minute at the end, it's like, oh, here's why, it would have just – it would have been a really cheesy reveal.
More like the whole subplot with Letty from the other film where finally it happens at the end of the film or close to the end of the film. The stakes become just about, is she ever going to come back to the family, basically. And so here, the movie does go in a different direction, and I think it probably is a better film for it. I just remember watching the trailer and being intrigued by the notion that maybe he really does turn their back, and when he's kissing Charlize Theron, it's because he's under some kind of spell to probably throw out another soap opera type element.
Well, but let's just throw magic in.
We get why not? At this point, anything is believable.
Element, you know, so they can go to New Orleans.
With this movie franchise, it would be more like they slapped a chip on the back of his head and hacked his wet hair.
Well, I thought maybe that was the case, but it's not. Spoiler alert: they did not throw a chip into the back of his head.
Jennifer, did you have any thoughts on that?
Not that I can get into without spoiling it too much, but I'll just say that I agree with Tasha. And if they hadn't established like pretty early on why he had gone rogue, I would have been very distracted throughout the movie. Wondering, like even during that short period of time where we didn't know it, I was trying to figure it out in my head, thinking like all these, you know, ludicrous possibilities we're throwing out, you know? So I'm kind of grateful that the film just did away with that mystery and leaned into the stakes. My bigger issue with it, which is the one I can't really get into too much without spoiling, is just like basically the way that Charlize Theron's character approaches Dominic for the first time and the way that that storyline is kind of kicked off, I think, is handled a little confusingly. But
Well, you can probably find more about that if she can navigate it without too many spoilers in Genevieve's review, because you are going to review it.
Yes, at Vox.com.
At Vox.com. And Tasha, I'm imagining that you're going to review it at The Verge.
We've actually already got our main review up, but I'll be engaging in a staff conversation about some of the issues that the movie brings
up. Yeah, I think there's a lot more to say about this film. I think it may even require a Next Picture Show pairing, I don't know, Bullet or something. I'm just spitballing here.
Death Race, come up with something. Death Race 2000.
It may have been discussed. We're not sure yet.
Okay.
It may have been discussed in some
detail. On the table.
Scott Tobias won't appreciate this film. He just won't.
You know, it's almost like Scott does not live life one quarter mile at a time.
You know, it's so true. Sad, but true. Genevieve, Tasha, thank you so much again. Vox.com, TheVerge.com, and The Next Picture Show, which you can find in iTunes. And you can find The Fate of the Furious in theaters everywhere. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right, you get style points for that one. I don't know why you're doing this, but I know one thing. You love me. Fire!
Hang on to your ass!
Dom!
My thanks again to Genevieve and Tasha for joining me. The Fate of the Furious is currently in wide release. If you've seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. We're just going to do a quick check on the Hemi and get some new tires, and we'll be back with more Fast, More Furious. Josh and I share our top 5 Fast and Furious moments. Stay with us.
One more ride.
There's a major exploration afoot.
Terrible disease, murderous savages. The journey may well mean your life.
If we may find a city where one was considered impossible to exist, it may well write a whole new chapter in human history.
Geez, terrible disease, murderous savages, an inevitable death. Sign me up. from the trailer for The Lost City of Z. That's Charlie Hunnam as British explorer Percy Fawcett. Lost City, directed by James Gray, himself on a new kind of exploration. His first five films all took place within New York City's five boroughs. This new one set largely in the Amazon jungle and based on David Grand's best-selling nonfiction book. We will have a review of Lost City of Z on next week's show. Josh will be back for that. I will give you a little spoiler alert. I'm a fan of the movie. If you get a chance to see it this weekend, I do recommend it. We're also going to do what we think should be a fun top five movie expeditions that we'd sign up for. And as you heard me just suggest there, and if you've listened to the show for a while, you know that I'm not a camper, so I'm probably not going to be signing up for a trip heading up the Amazon. What Josh is going to have to answer for me is whether or not existential crises count as expeditions. If they do, I'm golden. So look forward to that next week on the show. A couple of quick notes, a reminder to our Chicago listeners that the Music Box is hosting a complete David Lynch retrospective beginning Thursday, the 27th of this month. All of Lynch's feature films will be presented and all in 35 millimeter prints. Dune is playing, but it's the only one not in a 35 millimeter print. And all of these films lead up to the May 5th debut of the new documentary, David Lynch, The Art Life. Our friends at the Music Box asked just to put a special word in about the Friday, April 28th late screening. The only title currently listed for that 9:30 show is Lynch's Industrial No. 1, which was a 1990 commission from the Brooklyn Academy of Music, but they plan to supplement that with all of Lynch's music videos and TV ads, plus, quote, two or three very long things that we're not allowed to say what they are, end quote. So, if you're a Lynch fan, that certainly sounds intriguing. More info about the Lynch retrospective is available at musicboxtheater.com or in the show notes at filmspotting.net. That's where you will also find our poll questions. And in the dreaded first poll question after Film Spotting Madness, we've actually got quite a contest in our Class of 1990 poll. Four actresses all born that year. If all you know about a movie is the star, whose movie do you pick? Jennifer Lawrence, Kristen Stewart, Margot Robbie, or Emma Watson are the choices. Watson was the inspiration for that poll, as she is currently having a moment with the success of Beauty and the Beast, with another big starring role coming soon. The Circle with Tom Hanks comes out in May. Last we checked, Lawrence and Stewart in a dead heat for the lead in that poll. You still have a chance to vote, though. We'll keep this one open for another couple of weeks till probably Monday, May 1st. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. All right. Let's get back to the cars, shall we? Back in early 2015, Furious 7 showed up as one of the early big releases on the movie calendar. We were just coming off the prestige Oscar season, and we had an appetite for something a little less heady, let's say. So Josh and I talked ourselves into plowing through the Fast and Furious franchise in time for that April release of 7. The following top five Fast and Furious moments captures that magic time in all its glory. Enjoy.
I hear Rio's nice this time of year.
Cops are getting hungry.
Then I guess we're doing our job.
I'm a walking target. I don't want you around when they catch up to me.
Ride or die, remember? Dom, how long have we been doing this? And now all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it's too dangerous?
You're listening to Film Spotting, where ride or die is also the words we live by. We are sharing our top five Fast and Furious moments, looking over all seven films of the franchise so far. What five scenes, sequences, or maybe just those little moments themselves stood out the most for us as the most memorable? Josh, I am dying to hear your five scenes.
Yeah, the reason I thought moments would be perfect is because, having only seen the first film even, I could tell that these were pictures that had those little flickers. There were going to be things maybe we laughed about, things that just weren't the sort of films we're into, but there were going to be flickers where everything came together, and probably mostly action scenes, racing scenes, but also that sort of sublime ridiculousness that I talked about when we were reviewing Furious 7. And there's actually a comment here from a very minor character in Tokyo Drift that I think set me up for how I wanted to think about this list. It's Natalie Kelly. She's really one of the poor female parts in the franchise. Mm-hmm. But she does describe at one point in this monologue the nighttime drive she'd take up in the mountain roads. And she just says at some point, it's just the moment. And that's right. That was right for me. I mean, this franchise has been a collection of just these really nice moments. So that's what I've selected here. My number five does come from Tokyo Drift, even though I didn't rank it all that highly, but it has this spectacular vehicular mating ritual.
Hmm.
Totally throwaway moment.
Yeah.
But I love what director Justin Lin does here. This is the film that he came on to the franchise with. It's the third film. And he really upped its game in terms of form, I think. He has this kinetic camera. He employs a judicious use of slow motion here and there. It just has this overall lucidity that does go on to be one of the hallmarks of the franchise. So this is where Lucas Black and Sung Kang, they're the Paul Walker, Vin Diesel stand-ins in this
Yeah, he plays Han
version.
Throughout the franchise.
He does, yeah.
We
he
don't
does
see Lucas
continue.
Black again, except briefly.
Very briefly, and a little bit older.
Yes,
as we
is.
All are. Well, here they're driving around Tokyo, and they notice these two women sitting at a stoplight in their own souped-up race car. So the men's car proceeds to squeal in this circle, and it just continues. Like, I don't know how many circles they do around the women's car, number of turns, until the women smile and hold out this sheet of paper with their phone numbers. The guys, they straighten their car out, race by in a blur, and just grab the paper as they pass. And meanwhile, Lin's camera is a part of this as well, because it gets this overhead shot where it too is spinning in a circle. So it's silly, it's sublime, and it's sort of the franchise's version of a meet cute. This is how you meet cute in the Fast and Furious world.
It is, and it does tie back to something Lucas Black's character asks earlier about, well, what do you race for then if it's not for other cars? And he gives you the answer there, Han does, with that mating ritual. My number five, Josh, comes from your favorite installment in the series, Fast and Furious, which is the fourth, if you need a little bit of help distinguishing them. And I like that ride or die dialogue we came in with here with Rodriguez and with Vin Diesel, because it isn't all about, we talked about this a lot with Furious 7, those big bombastic action moments. It is sometimes about, believe it or not, the dialogue and the interplay between characters and the emotion. And there is a dialogue scene between Brian and Mia Toretto, Jordana Brewster, who, of course, is the sister of Vin Diesel's Dom. And they had a relationship going back to one. She felt betrayed. They finally come together in a sequence here in four, where they come together and get to finally kind of confront each other about their past and maybe their future. And I like this scene a lot. I'm calling it the lying to yourself scene. I like it for two reasons, and I picked it for two reasons. One is, it was for me the first profound bit of dialogue in the series that didn't strike me as totally cornball. I actually think that there are a couple really good dialogue scenes delivered really well by Sung Kang, who plays Han, in Tokyo Drift, but I watched Tokyo Drift at the very end. I thought I'd already seen it, and so I wasn't necessarily going to revisit it, but after seeing Seven, I wanted to go back and finally see it. I'm glad I did, because it turns out I'd never seen the whole film. But he has a couple of good lines, but through the first film and certainly the second film, none of the scenes where anybody ever tried to be serious or heavy about anything worked for me. Not even in your beloved Fast and Furious 1, Josh.
Oh, we'll get to that in my next pick.
Oh gosh. I had a feeling we would. But in this scene, both actors are performing with conviction, just earnest enough, not overselling it at all. And this conflict is the other key theme of the franchise for me beyond family. What do you stand for? Who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? Part of what makes Dom so compelling as a hero is that he doesn't worry about those labels. He's established his own code. He lives his life. He has his own sense of right and wrong. Brian has no idea. And that's partly why he's drawn so much to Dom's character and his clarity. Mia nails him on it in this scene.
I lied to you. I lied to Dom. I lied to everybody. That's what I do best. That's why the feds recruited me.
Maybe you're lying to yourself. Maybe you're not the good guy pretending to be a bad guy. Maybe you're the bad guy pretending to be the good guy. You ever think about that?
Every day.
It's not a coincidence that this whole series then, for me, really takes off once Brian figures out the answer to Mia's challenge, which happens at the end of this movie.
Which is exactly where we'll get to later in my list. Yeah, see, for me, my number four is going to be one of those moments that you probably did bristle at. It's the I live my life a quarter mile at a time scene in the Fast and the Furious.
So hokey.
I'm sorry, but you don't get to apologize for the corniness later in the series when it's right there from the start And it's the same essence. And I feel like it's being delivered with the same sincerity on the part of the two actors. And I appreciate that there isn't any sort of ironic level going on here. Sure, they grow into their parts a little bit better as the series goes on. That is inevitable, Paul Walker especially. But this scene here, when I first saw the movie, I sat up and thought, okay, this is a movie that maybe is being thought of by the studio and marketers as something for 14-year-old boys. But you know what? The people involved are taking it seriously, and that's coming through on the screen. So I do unironically appreciate this bro bonding that goes on, especially right here. This does take place in Dom's garage. It's the first time we get a sense of who he might be beyond this suspicious street racer. We're not sure if he's a criminal, how much of a criminal he is. We get a little bit behind that layer here.
That's my dad. He's coming up in the pro stock car circuit. Last race of the season. A guy named Kenny Linder came up from inside in the final turn, clipped his bumper and put him into the wall at 120. I watched my dad burn to death.
I talked about before in our review how it's, you know, this isn't my language that they're talking, but they're unmistakably sincere. There's no posturing, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. I don't sense any posturing here. It's just a scene where Dom shows Brian his garage and opens up a little bit about his past.
I live my life a quarter mile at a time. Nothing else matters, not the mortgage, not the store, not my team and all their bullshit. For those 10 seconds or less, I'm free.
I think that it speaks to also that being in the moment ethos that drives the best action scenes. There's a purity there, and it's a little bit a earlier version of what I talked about introducing my list, the just the moment comment that Natalie Kelly makes in Tokyo Drift. Here, Dom talks about being in the moment, and I just like how that echoes something that will carry through even the action scenes.
Yeah, it really is where one kind of goes off the rails for me, unfortunately. And it's not irony so much as what you said in terms of growing into their characters. They really do grow into their characters.
They do.
They really do grow into their performances. They both, Diesel and Walker, get so much better as this series goes on. And it's not the lack of sincerity. It's too much sincerity. It's the over-earnestness that I didn't feel in that Brian and Mia scene that I had at number five. And I felt, Josh, that it was so forced in there to give this character
some depth. They're comfortable. They're so comfortable there.
They're comfortable there, but the way it's forced into the script is what stuck out like a sore thumb to me. And I do think ultimately the ethos he verbalizes there doesn't even hold up over the course of the series that much. So it felt like
a little bit of pseudo-macho
blather to me.
When I was watching it again, he has a line there about, you know, he doesn't even care about his family,
yeah,
which isn't something they've established yet. So, yeah, I get that. But overall, this idea of the purity of the race, why they're in this, again, beyond the money, beyond the phone numbers that you get from girls, that was there right at the start of this conversation.
That stuff about his dad and the guy he hit that hit you hard.
Oh, yeah. When he talks about being how he was scared.
Ugh.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it brings a level of humanity to this. That this is somebody who can be scared. And it also speaks to another through line. Now that you mentioned that is when he talks about how he got banned from the races for this act of violence. There's this consideration over how violent is Dom going to get. And I think it is, which film is it where the first one with The Rock, so Fast
Five,
where he holds off the wrench from just...
It's five.
Right, yeah, because that's when the first time we see The Rock, and he could crack The Rock's skull
They're
open.
Calling back to
so
one,
it's,
which
it's,
I'm
yeah.
pretty sure they'd
so
actually already done at least
there's
once before
a lot
that.
Of, yeah, it's a through line. So there's a lot of bedrock stuff in one that the other series feeds off of, and I think that's because there's some pretty strong stuff there.
Okay. I'm glad you feel that way. My number four is a scene that I have to give full credit to our partner over at Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit, Allison Wilmore, because after I saw Seven, the next day, her BuzzFeed ranking of the series popped up in my Facebook feed, and she had a little line in there about basically like, come at me, you know, and it's like, okay, well, how audacious can these be? How contrarian could her picks be? And I looked, and you think you're putting the fourth film at number one is a little bit nuts. How about Tokyo Drift? as the best film.
I was going to say, please tell me she didn't go too fast
in the franchise. No, that would have been so awesome. But reading that clinch for me that I was going to go back and watch Tokyo Drift or watch it for the first time ultimately, and I might not have been as tuned into this moment without her focus on it. And it's the scene where Lucas Black's character, Sean, is riding with Neela, I think her name is. You've mentioned the actress a couple times.
Natalie Kelly, yeah.
They are in this chase sequence with the Drift King, the baby gangster here in this movie, and they're going through Shibuya Crossing, this incredibly busy intersection. And Allison describes it this way. She says it's the series' most sublime moment. The neon-lit intersection is one of the busiest in the world, but as people scramble out of the way of the charging car for a moment, everything is still. It's not the speed that's the most thrilling part of the series after all. Despite the name, it's the quiet in the midst of all of it that's where the lunatic lyricism can be found. And she's right. As you watch it, it isn't just the stillness of it that catches you off guard a little bit and kind of allows you to breathe amidst this insanity of this chase sequence. It's the visuals themselves. You mentioned how Justin Lin kind of pushed things forward a little bit, and I agree with that to an extent because I think it's the only frame you could take out of any Fast and Furious movie and actually compare it to a Kiarostami movie, because it feels just like the scene we love so much, Josh, in Like Someone in Love, mm-hmm. one of his recent films. The reflection of those lights on the windshield as they're sort of frozen in time for a moment. Again, as Allison says, in a series it's all about speed, 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 to have that one moment where everything just calms and then we get right back to the chase, it is sublime, and it's my number 4.
You know what one stands out to me like that as well? It's an honorable mention, but I'll just throw it out there now since we're talking about these quiet moments, is at the very beginning of Fast Five, where Brian and Mia are on the run. It's just setting up the film, and we get this slow scene of them driving at regular speed. They look dirty and mm-hmm. sweaty and tired. And I remember thinking, am I watching the right film? Because I've never seen a car go this slow.
You're talking about Five. Yeah.
Five.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's one of the reasons I love that movie and talk about how sophisticated it is compared to the others is because of the way it opens.
Yeah, that's really good. All right, we're up to number 3, and my number 3 comes from my favorite Fast and Furious movie, Fast and Furious. I'm going to call it Driving to the Dark Side. It's what you alluded to earlier at the end here. Now, foremost among the reasons why this is my favorite one is because I think it really explores most deeply the idea of the theme of the cop and robber being two sides of mm-hmm. the same coin. And this is common to Hong Kong action movies like Drug War or Infernal Affairs. And it's really well executed here, I think, with Brian and Dom both going undercover. They have their own reasons for doing this to take down a drug lord. It's really a repairing of this relationship movie because they're still at odds when it begins and they slowly come together by the end. And the final moment, this ending, is what I do want to pick. It's after Dom's been captured. He's been convicted. So he's on his way to jail on a prison bus. And of course, it's as all roads lead in the Fast and Furious franchise through a barren desert with mountainous terrain in the background. So they're driving along and suddenly this team of cars zooms up from behind, which we know mean to rescue him. And who's driving the lead car? It's Brian, which means he's made a clean break here from the law. Mm-hmm. And he's now officially committing to Dom's team. It's a quick scene, but I love the details. He's in a black car, which maybe you think doesn't mean much. But he's also an American muscle car, which maybe you think doesn't mean much. But we know he usually prefers bright imports, right? That's Brian's style, but not here. Also, Dom sitting in the prison bus. I love how he knows what's going on.
Yeah.
How? The engine.
Of course.
Here's the engine. He's like, okay, that's all I need to know. And this leads to what I think is a great cliffhanger ending mm-hmm. where we don't see what happens until the next film, as
yeah.
you talked about. I just love how they, at this point, they had the confidence and the commercial clout to be able to do that in a way that really does pay mm-hmm. off.
Well, going back to my number 5 pick, there's something always a little bit thrilling about watching someone finally figure out who they are. Even if they're going to the dark side,
uh-huh.
as it turns out, or what many might perceive, society might perceive as the dark side, at least he's finally embraced his true calling, which up to this point, he hasn't been able to do. Before we get to my number 3, we did put out a feeler on Facebook and Twitter for some voicemails. We asked our listeners to weigh in with their favorite Fast and Furious moment. We got this from Josh Youngerman. He is in Bushwick, New York.
Scene where Letty saves Dom in Furious 7, and then the scene where Dom saves Letty in Furious 6. The reason I think these work so well is they sort of underline the themes of family and love that this series has. And also, as ridiculous as the action is in these movies, and they are ridiculous, the reason it's grounded is because you actually care about the characters. So I think that central relationship, while, you know, the bromance is still very strong, that central relationship is key to why these Fast and Furious films speak to such a wide audience. Thank you very much.
So Josh, as you're well aware, Josh Youngerman, a huge fan of this franchise.
He likes his Fast and Furious movies.
We like to think we're experts, we're dilettantes compared to Josh at this point. And he did cheat a little bit there, connecting scenes from two different movies with Letty and Dom. And that dovetails nicely into my number three pick. It's another dialogue scene. It's another key line of dialogue, I think, in this whole series. It's from Furious 6. And as much as I do think this is a step down from Fast 5, it's in this exchange, which happens between Dom, Vin Diesel, and the bad guy, Owen Shaw, where Dom's true ethos, and by extension, the ethos that truly grounds this whole franchise, is laid out. And it's certainly all over Furious 7. It isn't that quarter mile at a time macho talk. It's the living by a code that puts family above all else. And as we noted during our review, family doesn't just mean who you're related to by blood.
That's great in the holidays, but it makes you predictable. And in our line of work, predictable means vulnerable. And that means I can reach out and break you whenever I want.
At least when I go, I'll know what it's for.
Well, at least you have a code.
Dom's great line there, at least when I go, I'll know what it was for. Pardon me, Josh, for trying to make this all a little bit deeper than it may truly be. But what more can any of us ask for when we go, really? Yes, family and that type of love and that type of connection is messy. It does make you vulnerable, but it's more meaningful and it's more satisfying than something like what drives the other guy, which is precision. The little chat does end nicely, too, with one of Shaw's men ready to take Dom out because he knows Dom isn't going to break his code. So he comes prepared to not let him disrupt his plan. But, of course, Dom has some backup of his own, as we see in The Rock. And we get this nice little showdown between these two rivals. This whole conversation is something that could almost be taken out and plopped into a classic Western on the streets of some frontier town between these two gunslingers. And I really like that scene, but I really like what it's ultimately about and how it connects to the whole series or the whole franchise more than anything.
Yeah, I did like that precision ethos that the Luke Evans character had. That's why I think he's one of the better villains, is he's not just this drug lord.
Yeah, at least he has a code.
He has this vague goal, that's for sure, the James Bond villain goal. But I do like how you see that in even the cars that his team has, this sense of precision. So he's definitely a plus in that film. My number two is coming from the conventional favorite, Fast Five, and it's the cliff jump. This is at the end of the Brevere opening set piece. After Dom has rescued Brian, and just before he collides, he's jumping off this train and he's going to collide into the bridge that's going over this enormous canyon. So he jumps on Dom's car, doesn't crash, but then they're too close to the edge. So what are they going to do? Well, Dom hits the gas, of course. What else would he do? And gives them as much elevation as possible, the chance to time their jumps from the car into the river that's way, way, way down below. Again, it's a single shot, really, that I'm picking out here. When we cut to that medium shot, looking at Dom and Brian from the hood of the car, slow motion, the music and sound effects cut out, except for the wind. All we hear, there's this purity to it. And their faces. I mean, if you think about, now, how does an action star act, really, besides having charisma, maybe, or a persona? How do you actually act in when you're doing something? They're not actually jumping off this cliff, but they're still acting out action. And they really, the expressions they pull work. I mean, you get a rare look of concern from Dom in this scene. Like, he's not quite sure how this is going to go. Brian, one thing I like about Paul Walker throughout the series, he often will show fear when something crazy is going on. And you definitely see that flicker of fear here. Yet both of them, there's something else on their look that says, this is surmountable. We can figure this out. If we've survived everything else, we can figure this out. So they're not just purely scared. So even if this was all CGI, I think those faces would make it worth it. And they did use a green screen for that medium shot. But I did look, and I found, maybe we'll link to it in show notes, how they did it sequence as well. And they used an air cannon to launch a Corvette into a canyon, not quite as high up, but they launched the Corvette out. Then they also had the stunt guys separately jump from the same spot. Mm. And then they put the two sequences together in post-production. But man, it definitely has, you buy it when you watch it. You buy the whole thing.
You definitely do. And I actually have that same sequence from Fast Five as my
earlier?
Number two.
Okay.
But there's a specific moment I'm going to single out that's different from the cliff jump. The train heist, though, I think overall is just a really thrilling sequence.
And it
might be really that first demarcation line that we've gone from the previous world, that split we touched on earlier, to this new James Bond, Jason Bourne, Mission Impossible world, where something like that cliff jump that seems totally ridiculous, but in the moment you completely buy it. That's where this shift really starts to happen with this franchise. And I'm going to keep the Western theme going a little bit here, because if you think about it, this sequence 60 years ago or so would have happened very similarly, except with horses.
On horses.
Riding up
Absolutely.
Alongside the train. And they'd be riding horses. They'd be stealing money or diamonds or something instead of confiscated cars. And they definitely would not have had that vehicle lift thingy that allows them do so conveniently slide cars off the train and then drive the cars onto the ground safely. I suppose, Josh, it probably wouldn't end with our two heroes riding their horses off a cliff into the water and surviving either, but this is the world of Fast and the Furious. Otherwise, I think John Ford would have shot it exactly the same way Justin Lin does. The barren Brazilian landscape actually seems ripped from a Ford movie. And I'm going to push it a little bit more here with my favorite part of the sequence. It's not O'Connor just barely making it onto Dom's vehicle before hitting the bridge or that jump. It's Vin Diesel's entrance. The movie opens with Brian and Mia and Vince, one of the characters from Fast and Furious 1, and them agreeing to take this job, which they think is just them stealing some cars. Diesel hasn't actually shown up on screen yet at this point. They haven't connected with him. And that lift vehicle thing pulls up alongside the train. We don't really know who's driving it or who's on it. And they start to cut the metal. And because I'm not a gear guy or any kind of tool guy, I can't tell you what that thing is.
That is called a metal cutter.
Metal cutter. Thank you, Josh. I knew I had you around for good reason. They cut this big open gap enough to fit a car in this moving train. And Lin then cuts to inside, where, of course, it's dark because they're inside the train. But as that metal side of the train falls off, the light comes in, and who walks in but Vin Diesel? He emerges from the light into the light, actually, where we see that close-up of his face. And I'd have to go back and watch it, but it feels like a little bit of a track forward on his face for dramatic effect, a la John Wayne and his entrance in Stagecoach. I think it's a really nice visual moment that Lin allows us as viewers to catch our breath, to welcome our hero, the alpha male, onto screen before the chaos really ensues.
Or how about the Searchers, the end of the Searchers, the sort of silhouette where you see the vista behind
You're right,
him
absolutely.
Too. So yeah, that is just a fabulous sequence. All right, my number one is racing across the train tracks from, yes, Adam, your favorite, The Fast and the Furious, the ending of the first film.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, I love this scene.
Old school.
It's the ultimate Fast and Furious moment for me because it's a thrilling stunt that also defines so much about the characters. These are the final moments. This is after Brian has tried to convince Dom to turn himself in. They end up having this argument, and it gets more complicated than this. Some bad guys show up, but basically at the end, they're left together, and they're going to settle this with an impromptu street race, as so often happens. They end up communicating everything from this point on through their actions, and it gets extra complicated once the race begins because a train starts approaching at the crossing that's lying ahead. So everything is heightened here once the train shows up. Is that going to convince Dom that he should give up and turn himself in? Like, this is, you know what? You've had a good run. Pull over. If not, how far is Brian going to go to catch him is the next question. Is he going to risk crossing the tracks himself? So it's a test for both of them in so many ways. And then we get that sublime shot just after they've crossed and escaped. They've burst through the gates and the train just fills the screen behind them. You've got the two cars and the train racing behind them. The capper is that they smile at each other in relief and also the thrill they've just experienced. It sort of defines this character camaraderie and the conflict that's really going to go on to define, for me, the heart of the series until they do get to be on the same team. Once that tension leaves, some of the attractiveness to me for the series leaves a little bit too. But here, it's there. It's setting so much up. I don't know if any, I couldn't find anything about how they shot this sequence, if any CGI was used here, or if they actually somehow timed that with the train. But it, again, it is entirely convincing and my favorite Fast and Furious moment.
It's a great moment. I liked it better when it was surfing in Point Break, but
you
it's a good
Point
moment.
Break? Jeez.
I do it just to annoy you.
Don't ever try to copy Point Break. It can't be done better.
Well, we're going to see someone try it as it's being remade, so I'm sure I'm going to loathe that film.
Yes.
My number one, after all this attempts at pontificating about connections to Westerns and the ethos of the franchise and these serious moments, I got nothing more. It comes down to flying cars. As listener Jarrett Green said it on Facebook, in Fast 7, when they drive dang cars out of a dang plane.
Really?
Yes. Come on, just in terms of
cars.
Pure, just the craft
now
of that whole sequence.
But you've criticized the CGI in other scenes. That's got to be a lot
it there.
Of CGI,
well,
don't you
yeah,
think?
Yeah, but it's not about CGI. It's about when you notice the CGI and it feels fake. And I do actually remember you brought up in Furious 7 during our review, the A-Team, and how they dropped a tank out of a plane. I've seen that sequence,
actually,
you know, flipping through channels.
It's like, done much better here.
It's horrible. I mean, granted, it's a tank, and you don't care about any of the characters, and it's not all these different cars and whatever. But everything about how this is crafted versus just the mass chaos of that, and the bad kind of chaos, not the zen kind that you appreciate and that I appreciate as well, there's none of that craft in something like the A-Team. Owen Shaw would appreciate the precision of everything about this sequence. And I just think the whole sequence works. It's that flip you talked about. It's the last second escape Paul Walker has. But it was just feeling that bit of vertigo, watching these cars on that big IMAX screen and then watching them somehow perfectly land exactly, well, except for one of them, land precisely where they're supposed to land and then see them carry out their plan. There was something beautiful about it.
You know what? I'll give you this. That's finally where Tyrese won me over. It took six films.
When his bravado just degenerated into abject fear.
Yeah, I kind of liked him there. That felt authentic.
That's my number one, flying cars in Furious 7. And those are our top five Fast and Furious moments. We have another voicemail, Josh, I wanted to get to, a longtime listener, Christopher Redman.
Hey, Adam and Josh, it's Christopher Redman here from DearCastAndCrew.com. I want to thank you guys for giving a little love to Fast and the Furious. This most recent film is certainly worth discussing, if for no other reason than I defy you to find a franchise that has gotten so much better and successful with each new film. I mean, Furious 7 actually made more money in its first day than Tokyo Drifted altogether. And I only jumped on the bandwagon with Fast 5, where that train sequence single-handedly elevated the series, in my opinion, to must-see status for all action fans. But my favorite moment is actually the post-credit clip from Fast and Furious 6. Now, without giving anything away, they kill off a major and beloved character after the movie was done. I mean, after the movie was done, think about that. Not only that, but they also introduced my man crush, Jason Statham, as the big bad for Furious 7. So the last 2 years of waiting have been kind of torture as a result, but the wait was worth it. This series is truly pushing what's possible in action cinema, and I defy anyone to see it and not have a good time. So thanks, guys, but if you'll excuse me, Daddy's got to get to work.
So he, too, loves the train sequence at the beginning of Fast 5, but his number one, I'm embarrassed to admit, because I never stick around for these, is the post-credit sequence to number 6. I saw a couple people reference this, that everybody knew that Jason Statham was going to be the bad guy in Furious 7 because it was foretold in Fast and Furious 6. I didn't know that.
Yeah, we stuck around for those credits. Saw that too.
Yeah?
Yeah. Well, the music. How could you not? Why would you want to turn that music off?
No, that's a good point. We do lose a key character at the end of that as well, but I'm going to have to put the DVD back in and watch it just to enjoy it as much as Christopher did. What about any honorable mentions, Josh, that you really regretted leaving off your Fast and Furious moments?
Well, Joshua Youngerman talked about the Dom Letty relationship, which I did really appreciate throughout this franchise. So I thought about putting the one that I think he may be referencing, or it might come right after that, where they're comparing scars. Dom, at this point, she still has amnesia. I love that. I love that there is an amnesia subplot in this franchise as well. That actually works.
Oh, of course, because it goes back to Jason Bourne a little bit.
Yeah. And here he's trying to jog her memory by comparing the scars. Mm-hmm. One that they've got together at the same time. So that's from Fast and Furious 6. Dragging the vault at the end of Fast 5, I mean, that's another reason I think people hold that up as the favorite, because it's bookended with these huge action set pieces, and Dragging the Vault is pretty good. And then I did have one I thought about from Furious 7, not the flying cars, but Plain Chicken. Twice in this film, there's a game of chicken that ends. I at least have never seen a game of chicken in a film end this way. No one's dared.
Speaking of mating rituals in cars.
A little bit. So I thought about that one.
Okay. Well, I've got a few here as well, including from Tokyo Drift, another one I did think about when Sean has his first race in Tokyo against the Drift King. Not only because we get some great camera stuff, because he gets so soundly thumped.
Yes,
and that
yes.
little bit of humor as he limps to the finish line. Works. The fuel tanker hijack at the beginning of your favorite Fast and Furious 4, mm-hmm. because it calls back to Fast and Furious 1. And you think about how that movie begins and ends. We haven't seen these characters in 2 or 3. So it's like Lynn right away said, hey, I'm getting the gang back together here. And everything's right with the world with that hijack scene. Very similar. As I touched on during our 7 review, when The Rock and Vin Diesel finally throw down after all that testosterone and that back and forth, they finally just get to unleash it on each other in 5. I like that. The tank rescue at the end of 6 is also really good. And in terms of just pure humor, the best line in the whole franchise is in Fast 5 when the team reunites and Tyrese asks Ludacris if he's going to give Martin Luther King's car back. And Ludacris says to Tyrese as soon as he gives Rick James's jacket back.
I
thought that was funny. But just to rub it in,
Not another Tyrese moment.
No. Actually, it does involve Tyrese because it's from Too Fast, Too Furious. Warehouse Scramble. The Warehouse Scramble as part of the big set piece in that movie. I think our friend, the very wise Sean Gilman, the dean of the Film Spotting Forum, one of the key members of the Film Spotting Advisory Board, I think in his Letterboxd review, he compared it to Minnelli.
Really?
With the colors dancing.
There is that overhead shot.
That's it. Yeah. It's good. Come on.
And Tyrese is in it. He's very far away. For the record, I think Tyrese is very good in Baby Boy.
He's very good in Baby Boy.
So I do like him as an actor. I think this series does not do him justice.
Really?
I mean, come on. I think
they used him just right in 7. Could have gone a little bit too far.
I agree.
They used him just right.
He won me over 7. By 7.
So you all wanted me to break into a police station. Fine. Then you asked me to stop a tank. I wasn't happy about it, but I did it. Then you came up with this brilliant idea to shoot down one of the largest airplanes ever. I shot that out the sky. It's nothing. But this right here, my friend, happens to be the stupidest idea I've ever heard of in my life.
Gibson's fool character never quite getting the respect he deserves or the respect he thinks he deserves in the Furious franchise. We gave him the last word there. That is our top 5 Fast and Furious moments from back in April 2015, and that is the show. Furious 8 or The Fate of the Furious is out in theaters now. You can send comments about that, the top 5, or anything else to feedback@filmspotting.net. At filmspotting.net is where you can find 12 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives, the brand new Film Spotting website coming soon. Hopefully this week you will see it unveiled in all its glory. If you haven't already, check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. Find both in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Out wide this weekend, Born in China. Free Fire, a 70s set crime drama about a gun sale that goes wrong. Ben Wheatley directs Brie Larson, Cillian Murphy, and Armie Hammer. A new horror sci-fi movie called Phoenix Forgotten. And The Promise, a love triangle set against the last days of the Ottoman Empire. Oscar Isaac and Christian Bale, how do you choose? Well, I say that, but come on. You know we're all choosing Oscar Isaac. Unforgettable, also out. A woman sets out to make life hell for her ex-husband's new wife. Rosario Dawson is the new wife. Katherine Heigl, the old one. Out in limited release, celebrating its 15th anniversary, Donnie Darko. The latest from Romania's great director Christian Mungiu, Graduation, and Norman, the moderate rise and tragic fall of a New York fixer. Here's the description. A financial schemer finds himself in the middle of an international scandal after he becomes a political advisor to the new prime minister of Israel. It stars Richard Gere, and let's say the term political advisor used very loosely there in the case of this movie. I've seen Norman, and we may have a few more words about it on an upcoming show, but I definitely recommend it. I was eager to see it, actually, because it's written and directed by Joseph Cedar, who wrote and directed one of my favorite films of 2012. I believe it was my number 7 film of that year, Footnote. So if you do have a chance to see Norman, check it out. The Lost City of Z, James Gray, goes to the Amazon, also out in limited release, and next week we will have our review of that, plus the top 5 movie expeditions we'd sign up for. I do think, in addition, we're going to bring on Steve Procopi, a.k.a. Capone, from Ain't It Cool News. He's going to highlight all the great titles that are playing the upcoming 5th annual Chicago Critics Film Festival. And for our podcast listeners, we're going to get the 5th film in our Agnes Varda Marathon 2000s, The Gleaners and I. What movie expedition would you sign up for? Leave us a short voicemail, and we may use it in next week's show. The number, 312-264-0744. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, the show wouldn't go. Thanks to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board, and special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.